Mr. Toastmaster, sir, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I trust it will not be deemed inappropriate if I deplore the absence of the plates, while at the same time expressing the hope that this state of affairs did not come about as a result of your Committee on Arrangements reading the advanced text of my remarks and deciding that the plates were not for throwing. Should any of you have difficulty hearing this not altogether trepid voice, I pray you remain silent, lest you, Mr. Toastmaster, have the experience that befell a Toastmaster in London when the speaker had droned on for many minutes to no particular purpose and had lost his audience, at which point a little man in the rear of the room rose and said, "Mr. Toastmaster, I cannot understand a single word the speaker is saying." At which point the Toastmaster rose, bowed graciously, and said, "I shall be delighted to change places with you." Gratitude, we are often told, is that measure of appreciation a man expresses for favors or benefits received. I am indeed grateful for your invitation this evening. And yet gratitude alone seems altogether inappropriate. For I have come not so much to share thoughts about Lincoln as to participate in the veneration of a legend. And legends, my friends, are not easily approached by mere mortals such as we. I come as an interloper in the shrine of Lincolnesque recollection. There are in this audience tonight experts of Lincolnia with credentials far better than mine. I note that in times gone by, your speakers have included such eminences as Alan Nevins, Bruce Catton, and Carl Sandburg. I know them all. They are scholars, historians, poets of the past. I am but a poor past broadcaster, a smatterer who was privileged to use his limited talent on an unlimited medium and who has chosen now to seek his daily bread in the public instead of the private arena. What novice, new come to Lincoln, could hope to improve on these phrases of Sandburg describing Lincoln as a man who is both steel and velvet, who is as hard as rock and soft as drifting fog, who holds in his heart and mind the paradox of terrible storm and peace unspeakable and perfect. One century has passed, and the paradox of storm and peace is still upon our land. Daily, the communications pour in from around the globe, relating the difficulties in the doldrums of threatened interests. Not too different, perhaps, from the cables that poured in on Lincoln from the front, relating the dread and the disappointments of secession defended. You will recall one cable said to have arrived at the White House with the signature, "General Hooker, headquarters in the saddle." A day passed, and another came with the same signature, "General Hooker, headquarters in the saddle." It was on the third such cable's arrival that Lincoln is reported to have remarked wryly, "General Hooker has his headquarters where his hindquarters ought to be." As you may know, I head an information agency with over 200 posts in 99 countries. Our headquarters are thus in the field, where our 1,400 Foreign Service officers occupy our version of the front lines. The hindquarters are back here, where I work, in Washington. I have just returned from a visit to part of those headquarters. 2 weeks ago, I was in Africa. For most of the month of January, I saw the fulminations of freedom that are welling up in those lands. I saw the anxious faces, the eager hands of black men reaching for their future. I heard the voices and sounds of a tomorrow being spawned in the toil of today. I felt the thrill of excitement, filling the hearts of these new men of Africa. These lands will never see their past again. Their voice and their dream is the ebb tide on which history flows. And as the sea's ebb tide is relentless and unceasing, so too is the ebb tide which carries their dream through these days in which we now live. There is in this, I suggest, an intense relevancy for us who revere the memory of Abraham Lincoln. If there was any one man who could shape the destiny of a land and a people for generations to follow, surely it was Lincoln. Forging the bonds of insoluble national union, molding the course of nation building, leading his people into and out of chaotic struggle, in which much was given, more was demanded, and all was committed. With blood strife their legacy, but nationhood their future. This was Lincoln, of course. But this, I suggest, is also Africa. Here, then, is one full factor that puts this country in league with the revolution of bright hope that is rising on our globe. We have a birthright on revolution. We are, in Henry Steele Commager's happy phrase, the oldest of the new nations, the first to be made out of an old world colony. Ours is the oldest written constitution, the oldest continuous federal system, and ours the oldest practice of self-government of any nation. And it is as a great revolutionary power that much of the world knows us. Our revolutionary documents are read and quoted worldwide. One of our small libraries in Africa had more requests for the Federalist Papers in a period of 4 weeks than the New York Public Library had in the course of a full year. Demonstrators rioting in another African land quoted in explanation of their conduct a passage from Thomas Jefferson. When Libya convened its constitutional convention, our agency furnished on request a copy of the U.S. Constitution to every member of the Constitutional Assembly, all, of course, translated into Arabic. Without exaggeration, that shot fired by the rude bridge that arched the flood has been quite literally heard round the world, and its echoes continue to reverberate across lands like those I visited in Africa. Lincoln fits into this picture more aptly than most. He does so because of his highly personal legend of the leader. Though born amid revolution, America was governed by aristocrats: Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Quincy Adams. These were all educated men of letters, aristocrats of breeding and bearing. The Southerners among them even held slaves. It was not until Andrew Jackson that a man from the people rose to the White House. But surely the most dramatized man of the people was Abe Lincoln. From log cabin to the presidency, from rail splitter to nation builder, from common man to the leader of men, this was the legendary route of Lincoln, and it is the legend of the leadership about this country that is popularized abroad. Lincoln, said Woodrow Wilson, owed nothing to his birth and everything to his growth. This was the path of Lincoln. This, I suggest, is also the path of Africa. Lincoln is justly celebrated as the man who kept a nation from rending itself asunder. But if this was his canvas, his theme was larger. The effort was not only to preserve the Union, but to preserve for the world the most successful experiment in free government that history has yet seen. Many of you will remember that he said in his first message to Congress in July of 1861, "It is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. Free men everywhere, he insisted, had a stake in the preservation of the Union, for the Union was the last best hope of Earth. As early as the debates with Douglas, Lincoln propounded his doctrine of freedom for all. He declared that the men in Independence Hall were speaking to the whole world of men when they enunciated their principles. They reached forward and seized upon the farthest posterity. They erected a beacon to guide their children and their children's children. They established these great self-evident truths, that when in the distant future some man, some faction, some interest should set up the doctrine that none but rich men or none but white men were entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, their posterity might look up again to the Declaration of Independence and take courage to renew the battle which their fathers began. Americans were, in Lincoln's words, God's almost chosen people. A civil war, then engaged not for our land alone, but for whatever land the fortunes of history might someday smile upon. Of equal relevance for emerging nations today is the very time in which Lincoln lived. The milieu of Lincoln was the milieu of the frontier, of a nation on the move, of the growing pains that marked its evolution from a primitive to a developing society. Lincoln, over a century ago, lived amid circumstances ideally duplicated in Africa today. Note these words. New nations would be carved out of old empires. Fabulous new lands would be explored and opened up for human settlement. And new struggles for human freedom would be won. The old, slow-moving, horse-drawn, and wind-propelled modes of travel would give way to the new. R. Gerald McMurtry wrote that. He was describing the America of Lincoln's day. He could as well have been describing the Africa of our day. Amid the difficulties of burgeoning nationhood and a pain-racked civil war that near prostrated the Republic, Lincoln proved himself a man of mighty principle. Lincoln had every reason to postpone the elections of 1864. The bloody war was in its fourth year. He had no assurance of his own re-election. But hold the election he did. Listen to his words, writ large on the pages of history, 1 week after that election. The election was a necessity. We cannot have free government without elections. And if the rebellion could force us to forego or postpone a national election, it might fairly claim to have conquered and ruined us. What has occurred in this case must ever recur in similar cases. The election, along with its incidental and undesirable strife, has done good, too. It has demonstrated that a people's government can sustain a national election in the midst of a great civil war. Until now, it has not been known to the world that this was a possibility. But it was a possibility, and the world saw it proven so. There may lie in this a moral for the newly arrived Brotherhood of Nations in Africa. We do not expect them to imitate our forms. On the contrary, contemplation of our civil war should make us tolerant of the difficulties of other lands. Our own forms were rough-hewn for us. Into them, our people have poured their blood, their toil, their work, and their worry. These forms, even today, undergo constant change and adjustment. Why then should we feel that our way is the best way for all other peoples as well? Discovering one's own path in one's own manner is part of the soil in which our root holes have grown. As we would not deny it to ourselves, so should we not deny it to others. But we do expect these other lands to be true to their own principles and practices. The lesson of Lincoln and the 1864 election amid the travail of civil war is a lesson ignored by others only to their loss. It says, it seems to me, that the way of the expedient and the easy is not the way of the strong. This, too, is part of the legend of the leader that is Lincoln. We celebrate this year the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. In a time when local problems have become global concerns, it seems prophetic that this epic pronunciamento on domestic freedom had foreign policy overtones as well. By making the extirpation of slavery one of the main objects of the war, Lincoln rallied the moral sense of England and France to his side. Britain and France could then only be unshakably for the Union. There was a tide of events running in the affairs of men, even then. One century later, the issue to which that proclamation was directed is still not at rest. The Negro has gained his freedom. He is still en route to gaining his equality. The proclamation resulted in political emancipation. Psychological emancipation has been longer coming. And the very nature of the Civil War has made its solution a difficult one. But because the war was severe, problems arising from it are, of course, severe. The South still has its bitter memories. Regional feeling and unity are still greater there than elsewhere in this country. And what more natural target for such lingering resentments than the very group which contributed a major issue to that fratricidal struggle, the Negro? The most important aspect of slavery to impress itself on my mind is that it was Negro slavery. It was designed to regulate the relationships between black and white. The Civil War and the 13th Amendment changed the status of the Negro. But the economic and social relationships of black and white were not greatly changed. Justifications of slavery before the war could be applied with equal force and relevance after the war to support continuation of the Negro as a subordinate. Indeed, in our Southland and my homeland today, there are phrases uttered that, but for the accident of time, could be relevant to the issues bound up in the Civil War. This is not to say there is here a pro-slavery sentiment in the 20th century. Certainly not. Quite the contrary. But it does suggest that underlying the issue of slavery was a relationship of status between black and white. The nation, one century later, is still engrossed in realigning that relationship. But the change of that relationship is inevitably stamped on the events of our day. Under Franklin Roosevelt, Negro advisors were appointed to the cabinet. Under Harry Truman, the seal of the president's office was implanted upon the report of his Civil Rights Commission, officially decrying the rights denied Negroes. In the 1950s, there issued a Supreme Court decision that may well rank as the 20th century Emancipation Proclamation, Brown versus Board of Education, pronouncing separate facilities as inherently unequal. And only last month, John F. Kennedy announced his intention of appointing the first Negro to sit in the president's cabinet. The Negro has come a long way in this land. He will go further. This country is indeed dedicated to the proposition that equality in the eyes of the law is not predicated upon color in the eyes of the beholder. This will take time, because this land is equally dedicated to the rights and privileges of all its citizens. To change a majority, one, I suggest, respects a minority. And it will take place peacefully, because this land is rooted in the soil of democracy and calm transition. This I believe deeply. There is no land where change so far-reaching and so affecting the body politic could take place in an atmosphere so free of frenzy. It is a measure of the strength of a people that we do what we must do in a way that comforts the conscience of people with opposing points of view. Saul Padover recently authored a book called The Genius of America. His chapter headings list the molders of the country as they seem to him best to be known. The American as a Democrat, Thomas Jefferson. The American as conservative, Alexander Hamilton. The American as Republican, James Madison. The American as Federalist, John Marshall. The American as philosopher, Ralph Waldo Emerson. I could not help but note this chapter with a simpler listing. The American, Abraham Lincoln. Perhaps that is how we best remember Lincoln, simply the American. Padover again says that America's most original contribution to political theory has been to have no theory. If true this be, then surely the capstone of our nationhood has been its people. If the American dream were to be summed up in the figure of but one solitary person, surely that person would be the solemn Lincoln. There was about him that most peculiar quality of manhood that history best calls destiny. In him was wrapped not the hope of one people, but the dream of all peoples. The Civil War was fought not only to unify this nation or to free its slaves, but for the freedom of men everywhere. Lincoln's lifespan of 56 years, 2 months, and 4 days is yet to end. And it may never, so long as men dare to tempt their dreams with the fervor of their hope. His was a newborn age. He came into the world while Tom Jefferson was concluding his 8th year of the presidency, that very winter that was the time of James Madison's inauguration and Bonaparte's invasion of Spain. A half century later, he would be the first president born beyond the confines of the 13 original states, even as 1 century later, John F. Kennedy would be the first president born in this century. And in this land of ours, born in revolution, tempered in struggle, united in blood, nurtured amid hope, and seasoned with responsibility, the rising nations of Africa see more than just history alone. They would elevate their gaze to a horizon, but dimly perceived by some, but a horizon to which all of us are, I think, inevitably bound. To some, it may seem they are caught in the pathological fervor of their nationalism. But I suggest that what we witness is but a fervent profile of what, but for the grace of the past 2 centuries, would be the early spawning of our own land of America.